face the sun and get crazy, have some fun. Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Worsham, and with us today is our very own favorite, one and only stand-up pediatrician, Dr. J. Sute in the Heeze.
How you doing there, Mr. Worsham? How's things going there in California?
Everything is actually pretty good. You probably haven't, well, yeah, you haven't heard this yet because the episode hasn't been released yet, but I am in the throes of building a fort for my children.
In a tree, or sort of.
Yeah. Well, we have a eucalyptus tree in the backyard, and I was gonna put it in there, but I noticed that when I put like a 3-inch screw into it with a 2x4, that it would, after a few months, it would just pull itself out. I learned from a contractor that works at KFI. He's got a great home improvement show. If anybody's so inclined, it's called Home with Dean Sharp, and you can get it on the iHeartRadio app, and I'm sure you can also get it on iTunes and listen to the podcast of the show.
Are you displacing any koalas?
Not yet. Not as far as I'm aware. Although I did, you know, what's funny is that I really wanted to climb up to the top of same tree and put a nest for a hawk or an owl.
Oh, yeah.
And in retrospect, I'm glad because there is already a small hawk that lives near us. And because
they become
big
hawks, Justin.
Yes, I know. And it was funny because I was working on said fort in the backyard, and then a hawk just kind of went and like kind of flew low over and landed like in a tree in my neighbor's house. And I was like, wow, so majestic, so beautiful. And then as I'm like looking up and then I look back towards the back door of my house, I see my two small dogs. And I just realized, I'm like, man, we better hope that they could only eat rats and not get too big before you rat dogs get scared, like carried away.
We've got hawks and coyotes as an issue for the little dogs out here in South Windsor. So.
Same thing. If you get closer to the mountains, the hawks get bigger and the coyotes will come, and you can't leave your chihuahua out in the backyard unsupervised. And I'm such a sick person because I'm sure if it happened to my dog, I would not be giggling. But just the idea of just sitting there, I've heard so many stories. See, I'm even giggling already. What an asshole.
Yeah, six little frou-frou dogs have been clutched and carried away by coyotes in South Windsor.
Now it breaks my heart. I don't know why this time it breaks my heart, but every other time I get it. I think I love that we think we have such domain over Mother Nature, but in actuality, we have very little control over Mother Nature, that if it got pissed off enough, it would royally fuck us up. But
imagine if it was like Jurassic World, where pterodactyls were flying and clutching and picking up humans and dropping them. So.
Yeah, we'd probably shut that down real quick. But so I'm in the middle of doing that. After I get done with this episode, I've got four support posts up. So I didn't want to put it in the tree, so I decided I'm going to put it up on stilt. So I've got these 4x4 posts, pressure treated, that I'm going to put with a concrete base in the ground and bury them, right?
And so you know how to do all this stuff.
Yeah, sort of. I mean,
God bless you.
To say I'm a licensed, you know, contractor would be way, way too much. But I mean, my dad is a licensed contractor, or was. I don't know if he's maintained his license. He just became a real estate realtor, actually.
Speaking of that, I put an offer in on a house this morning.
Oh, look at you, moving up in the world.
Yeah, a nice little plot of land away from people. And it's the outside structure is made of logs.
Really?
So it's like a log cabin in the woods with an indoor pool and central air. I mean, an in-ground pool and central air, of course. I'm not going to be roughing it.
Wow, look at you. You might have an Airbnb situation coming.
Got a little pond on there, apple orchard next door.
Wow, I got to be honest. I am getting more and more, we're falling down a rabbit hole, but I'm okay with it.
I'll send you the link so you can see it later.
Oh, please do. If you want, you can even post it on the Facebook page if you want to show everybody. I don't know if you want.
Yeah, I don't want anyone to swoop in and
steal it, because that's right. You've only got an offer.
I put an offer in, but, you know, my realtor seems to think it's a pretty good price. So, I'm sticking with his advice, which was just to give them what they want. It's only been on the market for 2 days, so it'd be nice to swoop it. I really don't want to go through the freaking goddamn trouble of boxing up my life again, but because I don't have any.
But this would be one more time, and then you'd be done, correct? Like that would be the idea.
They're going to bury me somewhere on the 3.5 acres. That's for sure.
Right underneath an apple tree is what it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, either that or just throw me in the pond and let me be fish food.
Well, I got to tell you, I don't know what it is, if it's an age thing or if it's just a career thing, but there's a big part of me that is kind of like, I wonder what it would be like to not live in California. Like, I want to know what it's like. I've got some pretty good equity in the houses, and just to be able to move someplace else. And I don't know, like it can't, it's, you know, you grow up in the same area all the time and you just think that's the best place to be. But what if it's not? Like, that's why I want to spend a year in England, like just to be like, see what it's like to live in a different country. I feel like Canada's too close. And I just want to be around London and England in Christmas time for some stupid reason. So I definitely will do that before I kick it. But what was the other thing I was in? Oh, so I'm building the treehouse on stilts, 5 feet high off the ground. And then I'm going to put like kind of Murphy bed, bunk beds in there, like almost like a battleship would have. You know,
nice.
So that, and I want to put a skylight in the roof so that it, during the day it'll light the place. And then at night, if the kids want to sleep out there, they can still kind of see the stars. Although in retrospect, I was like, well, if I put a bunk bed underneath there, then whoever's on the bottom bunk is never going to get to see. But I
never see the stars.
Maybe I'll put one on each side, or I feel like I need at least four. So if the kids ever want to have some buddies over, that they could go
out
there.
How about putting in a loft on each wall?
Oh, there you go.
And then both guys can see the sky and they both get to be in the top bunk more or less.
That's a good call by you. And then it gives opportunities to hang things underneath. And
yep, gives them a little more floor space too.
I've been posting on Facebook.com/dadpodcast or on Instagram @dadpodcast videos of my efforts so far. And by efforts, more failures that have come up. It's not horrible, but it's not going smooth, I guess is a better way to say it, which is normally how projects go with me and the kids. And somebody already commented like, no, this is going to be really great. They're going to have a place to sneak away with girls when they get older. And I was like, oh, that's actually interesting to think, though. I hope that I will raise my son.
You'll be putting in a waterbed.
Like a hard sheet. What if I did? That'd be great. But I just hope that I will raise my sons to be more gentlemanly, because the idea of some poor young lady losing her virginity in the fort in the fort is just like, there was a girl that I that lost her virginity with me. I'd already done it, but there was a girl in high school who, honestly, maybe I'm oversharing here,
but high school.
Ooh. Came very close to being Mrs. Worsham. Like, if there was a first runner-up to Mrs. Worsham, and trust me, this is a contest nobody entered in, nobody wanted to be a part of, but she was sweet. She was a beautiful lady. She's a great mom, too. Natalie, she's the only one of my ex-girlfriends that Natalie still kind of stays in touch with.
And you've been with Natalie since high school.
Since
too,
high
right?
school, yeah. So I dated this girl, and then probably, I think right after this girl is when I met Natalie. Like, it was.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, we did it at my parents' hot tub. And I was, and that was, that to me, like, well, that's nice, but it's your parents' hot tub. You know, so I was kind of like.
It's not like you're at, we have the Grantmore Inn here with the theme rooms and the heart shaped beds and such.
Oh, I got to do that too before I die.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not all it's cracked up to be, but
oh, really? It's not. It's,
no, I'm just teasing.
I just want to put it.
I know. I can't afford the Grantmore. I'm a pediatrician, for God's sake.
Oh, I didn't know the Grant. I thought, like, when you said the Grantmore with its themed rooms, what I was thinking, like, remember the Superman movie where they go to Niagara Falls and they got the vibrating bed and stuff like that?
That's
like,
exactly what it is.
Oh, really? Yeah. But those are high. Yeah. That's a high ticket item.
Well, compared to the Regal Inn that has hourly rates, of course, sure.
Good point by you. Speaking of love.
You'd be amazed at what you can get for $100 in a 4-pack of Red Bull up near Bradley Airport here in Connecticut. So it's
Red Bull's an actual commodity that's trade-worthy up there.
It's a requirement.
Oh, okay. All right. Speaking of love, I understand that you had a Valentine's mishap of some kind?
Well, you know, this, as you know, this is the first time I've actually had a Valentine in the last 6 years.
Yes.
So I've been seeing this very nice lady for the past 4 months or so. And you know, you want it, the first one, to be special. So last Sunday, the 11th, I figure, well, I'm thinking about it now. Why don't I just go ahead and, you know, arrange for some flowers to be delivered on Valentine's Day? So I go to that 1-800 flowers place and I order it. And, you know, the address is in there. I pay an extra $7.49 to have it delivered on Valentine's Day. I could have had it shipped for free on Monday or Tuesday, but they weren't Valentine's Day. So, you know, I pay the extra fee. It all goes through, you know, guaranteed delivery on Valentine's Day and such. So I go down to see her on Valentine's Day to go out to dinner, you know, assuming the flowers had arrived already. So, you know, the only thing I'm carrying with me is a little Valentine's Day card. And she likes the chocolate-covered pretzels. So I got a bag of chocolate-covered pretzels and the card, and I get to her house. No fucking flowers, Justin.
Uh-oh.
No flowers. Guaranteed, no flowers. So here's Uh-oh. Pretzel Boy, first Valentine's Day, holding a bag of chocolate-covered pretzels and a card, and no flowers on the first Valentine's Day at all. So I'm like livid. So I get on the phone to call 1-800-Flowers, and they must have outsourced a lot on Valentine's Day because they must have had a ton of calls. But yeah, this Nigerian woman that answered my customer service complaint couldn't even spell my first name, Jay. So I said to her, I said, can you draw a fish hook? So needless to say, the flowers did not arrive, nor did the flowers arrive first thing the following day.
Oh.
So I send an email saying, you know, you have this guarantee that is present on your site there. What is the process for when you do not fulfill the promises that you make? And I got a $20 gift card, and the flowers apparently are coming on Sunday.
So, oh, okay. But they don't comp the flowers?
They don't comp the flowers.
But you just get 20 bucks?
$7.49 I paid to have them delivered on Valentine's Day.
Wow. Yeah. Well, what for? If there was ever even a chance, I guess we just lost them as a sponsor on this show.
and you know, I'm saying to my friend, I said, we're talking, and she goes, well, you know, everybody gets flowers on Valentine's Day. It's, you know, it's more special when you just get flowers on any day, just out of the blue. And I said, well, I guess 1-800-Flowers feels the same way.
Yeah. Did she? I mean, I'm sure
you're getting them on Sunday.
I'm sure she was under.
As every time I talk to you, there's 4 to 7 inches of snow coming tonight. So I bet you they're not there tomorrow either.
Oh.
Another guaranteed failed.
Yeah. I'm sure she was at least understanding about the circumstance, though. Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
All right,
she's great. But I, you know, I was making a.
Well, it's hard, though. It's hard when you say, no, I ordered the flowers. You know what I mean? And she's like, oh, and then it's kind of a new relationship. Right.
Yeah,
so it's like. You know. Oh, but I did said, you God, like
this loser only brought me a bag of pretzels for Valentine's Day?
Yeah. Oh, love is hard. Love hurts. And
she's a good lady, though. I call we couldn't decide boyfriend, girlfriend sounds silly for us in our 50s.
Yeah.
So I went with my steady gal.
Oh, I like that.
That's what we're going with.
I like that.
We're watching Animal House, and when Flounder said to Otter, this is my steady gal, Sissy, I said, that's it. That's the one we're going with.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner. You know what's funny is that I just realized that I think I accidentally closed the page that had – there it is. Okay. The page that had all of the stuff we were going to talk about. I closed the web browser. So anyway, now I've got it open. One of the things that you sent – and I love all the articles Dr. J sends is, and this one is it's a little bit different spin on what we usually talk about, but I think it's helpful for parents and anybody really to kind of get some insight in behind the scenes of a doctor, because being a doctor, I think, is very interesting. You go to all this, you get all this education. And as Dr. J many times has joked about how WebMD and Google seems to do just as good a job as him with his education and background and research and keeping up on things. But also, like, Adam Carolla has a great analogy that always stuck with me, where when he was doing Love Lines with Dr. Drew, he said, I was a high school dropout. Like, I barely graduated high school. I got put on academic probation at junior high, and I started swinging a hammer and digging ditches and cleaning carpets right out of school, right? So he was a contract.
You're cutting out on me a little bit.
Oh,
I don't
know
if that's.
I hear you fine. Is it better now?
Now it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Now I can hear you. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So Dr. Adam Carolla was not educated, and he was swinging a hammer, and he would go to a guy who made $1 million a year and say, well, we're going to put a beam in your house here, then it's going to support the door frame, and then I'm going to square it up. And the guy would never question anything, even though most right. people who work in the construction world are usually ex-cons, he would say, or recovering addicts right. of some kind. He goes, but Dr. Drew would say, yeah, you really shouldn't be taking that many Tylenol in a day. And they go, what do you know?
right.
So I like it. I like this insight into the world. And what this article, the title of it is 8 Truths about pediatricians in 2017 and a few fallacies. And what they did was they put a bunch of pediatricians and they gave them a survey and then kind of collected the data on that. And I just wanted to kind of walk through these and then have you clarify anything. But the first one is four essentials. The four factors most important to having a good lifestyle are, and these are for the doctor, right? These are right. The top four priorities for the doctor. Number one, control of your schedule. Number two, time off. Number three, enjoying your work environment. And number four, enjoying the type of work you do. And so would this be saying that this is why people become a doctor? Because I can't imagine a doctor has too much control over their schedule.
Not that this is why you become a doctor, but when you do become a doctor and start doing it and realize, you know, the amount of volume of patients you're going to see, the amount of intensity that is involved. Those probably, I got to say, I agree. Those are the four factors. Now, we just had a long discussion. I think I may have told you the company that kind of bought all of our group practice came in and has tried to make some changes. And one of the big changes was changing the schedule from 15-minute sick visits to 10-minute sick
visits.
That's
right, yeah.
And to not have adequate time to spend with a patient when you know what the problem is. You already know before they walk through the door, it's going to take you 20 minutes and not have that time allowed, really set off a chain of events at my office. I mean, everybody was upset. Finally, after, muddling through December and most of January with their, schedule, so to speak, we sat them down and I said, I can't see myself working this at this pace and doing a good job for the rest of my career. So we either got to fix things or, I'm not going to see 27 to 30 patients a day and, feel like I'm having to cut corners in order to do it. So having control over the schedule, having a receptionist that know that, if a kid's coming in with cough and the kid has asthma, you can't do that in 10 minutes. They need a little extra time. And now that I've gotten a little bit of control of being able to schedule patients as not a cookie cutter 10-minute visit, all one size fits all, things have gotten better. I'd say the last 3 weeks have been terrific. So you do have to have control over your schedule because you know what you're capable of doing. And I'm not going to overextend myself and force myself to cut corners and make a mistake, because if I ever, had to do that and made a mistake, I don't know that I'd be able to come back to work the next day. What I'm doing is important. It's not a factory assembly line. So that's a real important facet.
So really what they're saying is after becoming a doctor, because the thing that you have the least control over is your schedule. And then if you don't have control over your schedule, then it's also hard for time off, and that the lower factors of enjoying your work environment and enjoying the type of work you do is that those are already there. So that's why it's not like it's not a necessity, because it's kind of built in. That's why you became a doctor. That makes sense.
I'll tell you, the time away from the office is wonderful, but no, I'm just teasing. I take Wednesdays off, the typical middle of the week doctor thing. I let my partner take Fridays off, so he gets a long weekend. But you do need a day to recharge. You also need a day to do the stuff that you got to get done, like haircuts and that kind of stuff. I mean, it's nice now. I have only one call commitment every eighth weekend. So I'm only on call maybe six weekends in a year now, which is terrific. So,
that's awesome.
You know, that time off or, kind of controlling your life outside of the office a little bit better is important too.
And that's it's funny because since having a 9-to-6 job, even though it's only part time, that's the thing I've noticed is like, how do people get a haircut?
right. I mean, but it's important
it's so
to do that.
Stupid. Yeah, but it's so stupid.
I've got a team of doctors that are required to take care of me. And, at least once a month, I got to go see one of them on a Wednesday.
That's great. This one is really interesting. We'll do this one, then we'll take a break, but it's the compensation fallacy. Who says pediatricians are not as passionate about compensation as other physicians? Our survey found that compensation ranked right up there as well. In fact, 67% of you gave compensation a 4 or 5 in importance on a 5-point scale. 58% of you are less optimistic about your ability to adequately provide care for your patients in 2018 than last year. The top three reasons why? 31% healthcare reform, 26% inadequate reimbursement, 21%, not enough time with your patients, which is exactly what you said. So what this is saying is that the healthcare reform, and is this reactions to coming out of Obamacare and them not having a solution for it, or is it Trump's new plan that seems, because I remember a lot of doctors kind of not being happy about Obamacare either. Let me tell you,
it worked out from my end in terms of compensation, timely payment, covering the antibiotics that we want to use and the specialists we want to use for the patients. I mean, it was seamless because most of what Obamacare was, you know, a subsidized private insurance companies, whether it was, you know, Blue Cross or Aetna. It was still dealing with a different arm of the same insurances here in Connecticut. And they, you know, kept right up with the private insurers. And in fact, you know, in some cases, we have the CHIPS program, the one that they just re-added to the budget that they threatened not to have. I mean, we were having to send patients of ours that are on they call it the Husky plan. It's part of the Children's Health and Immunization Program. They refunded it for 6 more years. But we were having to send letters out to people back in November anticipating that Trump wasn't going to put it in the budget and was going to cut the funding. We were telling people to get their checkups done before January 31st because that's when funding was going to run out. And then, of course, you know, with all of this, you know, back and forth and bipartisan, you know, partisan bullshit that they have trying to pass the budget, it finally got thrown in to the last plan that I guess they passed, the tax bill or whatever. And, you know, now it's funded for 6 years, but in 6 years it's going to come up again. And, you know, this is the program that allows for lower income families with children to have their vaccines paid for and cover their health care, not necessarily out of work people, but people who are working that just need subsidized health care. And it hasn't been as horrible as it was, but if every, you know, time a budget hearing comes up, they're going to hold over our heads, you know, the children's health care. You know, for pediatricians, it's scary. And that's why 31%, you know, are concerned about healthcare reform because, you know, we don't even know what this Trump care is going to turn out to be. Right now, everything's functioning as it has been before, just with less insurance companies participating in the, the marketplace.
Yeah.
And then again, when they run out of money or run short on money, they don't, you know, they put the premiums up, but everybody sees that. And what they do is they cut down the reimbursement for the same services. You know, I made more for an office visit 5 years ago than I make now. And does that make sense to you when we've had to implement electronic health records and computers and all of these expenses that my reimbursement for all of the requirements of Obamacare should have gone up to compensate for the expense of it. And they keep going down every year.
So what I like too about this is that they have just little quotes from people who are part of the survey, and these are doctors. And one of them said, "Until the government gets out of the exam room, it's all going to be a mess." And then another one is quoted as saying, "I spent more on healthcare insurance for myself and my husband than I made in the past 5 years," which is a really interesting. I don't know how that math could even work out, but
It probably had a big expense and. You know, didn't have catastrophic.
Yeah, coverage. Somebody, that's what I thought. Somebody had to have some kind of either, unfortunately, a form of cancer or some, you know, something big had to happen to him. The other interesting
people
part of this.
People lose their houses for not having insurance, you know?
Yeah, I don't. And, you know, not to get too political, but it's, I just feel like that I don't know. I wish I was more educated, but my parents both worked in healthcare. They weren't doctors, but they were kind of like grunts. My dad did anesthesia repair and was a biomed tech for a long time. My mom was a respiratory therapist for her entire career. She was a housekeeper, kind of. What's the term they use for that in the hospital? Like, she made the beds and all that in the beginning, and then went to school to become a respiratory therapist. And that's both of this. So they worked in the medical field nearly their entire professional careers. And their look at it is that if you got insurance out of the way and had less things subsidized, that everything would kind of come out in the wash, that there seems to be some kind of like overcharging that can happen from an insurance to the consumer, and not all of that is going directly to the healthcare. That a lot of that is coming to cover expenses from operating an insurance company, which is really interesting.
Which is a middleman that's kind of necessary.
Right. But. But it said, it also said, but of those who said they were optimistic about their adequate care prospects for the upcoming year, nearly 28% cited healthcare reform as the reason for optimism. So if I'm unpacking this correctly, is that the reason that you're saying 31% are saying why they're less optimistic is because the idea of healthcare reform means that you are a part of a system that is in flux, in change.
That's right.
And it's volatile.
And we don't know what's next.
But 28% of people think that the changing to the different way could be better is what they're saying, which would still sounds like a minority, though.
Imagine, nobody wants a single payer healthcare system, but imagine if all the physicians, and it was fair. I mean, that's got to be what it is, you know, you're adequately compensated. But imagine if we all sent our insurance bills to one place and had it processed by one place and didn't have to know the intricacies of, you know, 1,000 different insurance companies and what copays they are and what medications are approved on Aetna versus ConnectiCare versus United versus Blue Cross, which is what we do now.
Yeah, you almost have to have somebody who's running your office, right? Because it can't be expected of the doctor because they
have an office manager that does all of that. We have a billing department, so
and they need to have a PhD in understanding all of these systems. Or is it once you work in it for a few months, you kind of get a feel for what's what? Or is it really constantly changing? And
well, I mean, we have one system through the office that everybody in my organization uses. But unfortunately, you know, at the hospitals I go to three different hospitals. They have three different electronic health record systems that I had to go for training for. So, you know, we stopped going to one of the three hospitals because it's just too much time to work off of four different systems that are all different. So, and none of them communicate with each other.
Wow, that must be unbelievably frustrating. Let's take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll talk more of these eight truths about pediatricians in 2017 and a few fallacies. Oh, my favorite part of this song is the doing it, doing it, doing it.
Doing it, doing it, doing it, yeah.
Oh, that's a good song. Hold on, I got to do this because there's stop playing, you stupid, stupid song, because my board is all mixed up and I got Dr. J on the same channel as the stupid music that I was playing. Before I move on, though, I got to tell you guys about, because you've heard me talk about it before, and it's wink.com/dadpodcast. Wink, W-I-N-C. It's a combination of Wine Incorporated. And what this is if you say you like to have wine, or maybe you're a big wine aficionado or you're not, it doesn't matter. Even if you're the guy who's like me and you go to the grocery store and you pick your wine based on the label and the price point, then this is a perfect service for you. If you love wine, it's a perfect service for you because these are people who also love wine and they make it, and it comes directly to your door. So it's like a fruit of the month club, right? But it's wine. So what they do is you fill out a palate profile quiz. It takes about 2 minutes is what I timed it out to take it. And they ask you, even if you don't have to know about tannins or fragrance or any of that stuff. You know, all you have to know is like, do you like blueberries? How do you like your coffee? Do you like peaches? Like, what kind of flavors do you like? And they use that to build a box of wine for you. You get four bottles a month. The bottles start at just $13 a month. So these are custom built boxes for you. And it's the same price point that you're going to get if you go to the grocery store. You can cancel at any time. You could skip a delivery. So if you're not having a party or a bottle every week of the month, then you could say, hey, I'm good for this month. And it doesn't cost you anything. It's not a big deal. They don't charge you and then give you a credit. None of that stuff. If you get a bottle and you don't want it, you could send it back. No problem. Not only do they let you build it, but you can also, based on your profile, your palate profile, you can also customize the wine and change it up. Say, I want to try something different. Like, what's popular? And they can tell you what their best sellers are or what's new that they've just rolled out with. So again, trywink.com/dadpodcast gets you $20 off your first order. That's almost two bottles of wine that they're just knocking off. It's on the house, right? Trywink.com/dadpodcast. The link is in the description of this episode. Trywink.com/dadpodcast for $20 off your first order. All right, so let's get back into the eight truths about pediatricians in 2017 and a few fallacies. We're on number three, and this is electronic health records, which it says almost 25% of you cited EHR implementation as one of the top two barriers to your effective practice as a pediatrician. Break that down for us, Dr. J.
What it does is now you're sitting next behind a computer screen clicking on buttons when you used to be able to sidle up to the, you know, patient with a pad and paper and be able to look them in the eye. But the thing with the EHR that's helpful is the electronic prescribing. I think most people would agree that being able to renew prescriptions and send them right over to the pharmacy is a plus. But I'd say that that's really the only plus in terms of time. Everything else takes longer. And every month they add more buttons to click.
Yes, there's a quote in here.
It's like Lando Calrissian trying to climb out of the big hole that had the teeth on it in the last, as far as I'm concerned, the third Star Wars, the last one. And that's what it's like. You're trying to climb on quickstand, and every time you think you got it down, you come in on a Monday morning and all the screens have changed and there's new buttons to click.
Right, because technology is supposed to be a time saver, but one of the quotes from the doctors in the survey said, the things we have to chart to get paid are ridiculous, such as whether a four-month-old infant smokes or chews tobacco.
That's right, and we have that button on every checkup visit, whether they are a smoker or exposed to secondhand smoke, and I have to click those buttons every checkup because that's the algorithm for the insurance companies.
Wow.
And they don't care what the answer is. They just want a button clicked.
See, and in my experience for our pediatrician, she all of a sudden now they have like a laptop, and I think it's actually one of those laptops that spins around to use as a tablet too. But yeah, she carries in and then she sets it on the table. She does the examination. Sometimes she's even sat in there and like done her charting, I'm assuming early. And then she goes into the examination. And then what she's done while she's talking us through, she puts it in the chart. And what I have found as the patient, what I really like about it is that she clicks a button and she goes, you're still at the Magnolia CVS or whatever. And we go, yeah. And she goes, okay. And then any prescription that we get for ourselves or the kids, they automatically turn it into the pharmacy. And so In 20 minutes to an hour, we can swing by. Oftentimes we swing by on the way out of our doctor office because it's a few blocks away and then just go by and pick it up. That part I think is nice. So
helps us too. Now we can even e-prescribe controlled substances like Ritalin and Adderall in Connecticut. And rather than having the parents have to come to the office every month to pick up a hand-signed paper prescription, they now have the systems in place to be able to both prescribe and monitor the usage. And in fact, the pharmacies in Connecticut won't take a paper prescription now. It's got to be sent electronically through an EHR.
So it seems that the real issue is more the bureaucracy of the required coding for the insurance companies than it seems the ineffectiveness of the technology. Is that a fair way?
And the data mining that the insurance companies are getting. We have to ask each visit if there's firearms in the homes and all that background data. Somebody's looking at all that stuff, and you got to worry about that a little bit, And again, is it good to be able to look back and see what your weight was a year ago when you were here for a checkup? Yeah, it's convenient, but the other system of paper and pencil didn't prevent us from being able to do that either, Right. And when the system goes down, it's not like I have to, go and get another ink cartridge for my pen. It's a big pain in the ass when everything is on the computer and nothing's on paper anymore. And the system goes down on a Monday morning and you've got 12 patients coming in and don't have access to their allergies, what medications they're on, what they were in for the last time. So, it makes it a little dicey sometimes when you're so dependent on it. But, we know our buttons to click because without clicking the buttons, we don't get the incentives. And the reason they have us clicking those buttons is because they're doing studies or looking at data. And, basically they're making us data entry specialists for their nefarious plans.
The real reason, I think, I mean, sure, the data is helpful, right? Because then out of this, we're going to get like, this is how many firearms exist in American households in the Midwest or the in the New England area and all of that, right? But really,
or they might come for them.
The real reason, though, that I think that they're doing this isn't necessarily for that purpose, is that what they're really trying to do is to adjust actuary tables so that they can make sure that they're charging the right amount to assess risk of what could happen. Yep. It's no different than when you get, you know, apply for life insurance. And the ironic part about it is that these same insurance companies are creating mandates to say that you have to spend less time with a patient, but here's more information that you have to gather for the insurance companies that aren't necessarily about the health of the patient.
Right. And they get background data too. So they see, you know, if you are, say, I do all my charting in the room and put everything through and sign it before I move on to the next patient. But there are doctors that'll do like, you know, four patients, five patients that they'll, you know, type up at lunch, you know, and that's not going to be as accurate. And if there are mistakes, well, the background data shows that you finished seeing this kid at 10 o'clock, but you didn't write the note until 1. Yeah. So that's, you know, when you check into each patient's, I mean, all that background stuff is there too. So, you know, God forbid you go back and change something in a record and it turns out then you get sued and the record's been changed and then everything is under suspicion. I mean, thank God. I mean, it's going to be a quarter century in July. I have not had to go through that. But, you know, I'm a compulsive button clicker because I want to make sure I document everything, not just for the insurance company, but to make sure everything I discuss in the room is, you know, is in there. Yeah. And that takes more than 10 minutes, which,
no shit,
you know, when they, you know, it takes 10 minutes. Some of these kids are on so many medications that it takes 10 minutes just to reconcile their medications.
And
a
then
visit.
You got 5 minutes to actually assess and diagnose and treat them. That's insane. Right. That's insane.
Right. It's added time on. I find myself having to stay, you know, an extra half hour, at least a couple days a week just to finish up my notes or answer phone calls when, you know, a couple years ago, I was pretty much done by 5, you know?
Yeah. Which is, by the way, a doctor doesn't get paid overtime, right? You actually more right. like a salesperson. And it's such an interesting thing that people get uptight about doctors getting paid, I think, which is so stupid. It's like, no, we want them to get paid. We want people to – doctors should be making a lot of money because they do an important job.
A lot more. We should be making a lot more than lawyers, that's for sure.
No shit. The other thing, I just want to touch on this because I think these statistics are interesting, is that it also talks about oral health, because this is something as a parent I was completely unaware, and that what it says is, according to a study done by the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid – and on the uninsured, the tooth decay is the most common chronic illness among school-aged children, with about 1 in 4 children having untreated tooth decay. Nearly 44% of survey respondents provide oral care themselves. And you were saying during the break that this is just like a fluoride seal almost?
It's a varnish that you paint on the baby teeth. It's a fluoride varnish that, you know, is better than, a chewable fluoride tablet. But you do that and it helps to prevent cavities, and you reapply it when they come in for their yearly checkups, and they don't pay jack shit for us to do it. And quite frankly, most of my patients, I mean, again, I'm in a suburban area where people have access to dentists. I'd say, you know, by 2, 2.5, most of the patients in my practice have seen a dentist. So for me to spend, 5 minutes that I already don't have because I'm reconciling prescriptions and stuff, trying to fight a 1.5-year-old to varnish his teeth. I mean, that wasn't on the job description when I signed up, so I don't see me doing that anytime soon.
Yeah, and it said nearly 50% don't because of their confidence that patients are already receiving care at a dentist office. And this is shocking to me personally because I'm a guy who never had a cavity, but I seem to be, for a guy who never had a cavity as a kid or anything, I'm like hyper aware. My wife gets cavities all the time. And I have to do the teeth brushing in the house and the flossing because she's like, she, both of the.
Well, you're an expert. You have a track record.
But that's the thing is I always feel like perspective is such a strong motivator, and that I literally had zero dental care. Like, I brush my teeth once in the morning at night, but I never flossed. I was fortunate enough to have genetic teeth where I did not go to a dentist from age 12 until 27 years of age because my dad took me to a dentist at 12 and he said, oh, he's got like 5 baby teeth still in there and his chin is a little recessed, so we want to break his jaw, put on a headgear, we want to broaden his upper and lower jaw and like do all these things. And I later learned from an orthodontist, well, like actually that can help reduce snoring and sleep issues, blah, blah, blah. And I guess everybody's got a worker ant mentality where it's like, well, I'm an orthodontist. This is what I do. So obviously I'm going to see all of these things and I'm going to see them as important. Right.
Right. Right.
But my dad was like, well, he doesn't even have all his baby teeth and they want to put braces on. So in theory, he would have to pay for braces. Then I would lose my baby teeth and the new ones would come in. And then he would probably have to pay for braces again to straighten up the older teeth.
Double dipping. They call that double dipping. Yeah.
And I'm not saying that this was their intent, but my dad opted to not do it. And so he just stopped taking me to the dentist. And then I didn't think about it. And then I didn't have health insurance when I moved out. And so once we had oral like care, I went in at 27 years of age and they took a water chisel to my mouth and took boulders of plaque out of my teeth. It was gross. But the dentist and I go, this mother, because I still have my wisdom teeth, everything. And I was like, this motherfucker is going to come in. He's going to hit me with $3,000 to pull my wisdom teeth. And I go, and I'm going to know he's a shitty dentist because there's nothing wrong with my teeth. And within 30 seconds of being in that exam chair, the guy goes, wow, you need to find a grandfather or somebody and just give him a big old hug and a kiss for these genetics. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, these teeth are beautiful. He goes, when was the last time you saw a dentist? I said, I was 12. He goes, man. He goes, I have people, if they miss a 3-month cleaning, their mouth is falling apart. So just consider yourself lucky.
I go every 3 months now.
He goes, I've never seen wisdom teeth like in an adult male like this. He goes, but there's no real, he goes, you got a little overcrowding on the bottom, but everything else, he goes, there's plenty of room. He goes, there's nothing we need to do. I was like, fuck, this guy's good then, I guess.
Listen, the Soutte teeth are so goddamn bad. Growing up, my father's brother, my Uncle Eddie, owned the Soutte Dental Laboratory. He made bridges, fake teeth, dentures for all the dentists in Fairfield because he was doing half the business for relatives.
Yeah.
The other half was for the dentist.
But that's funny.
Yeah, so that's what he did for a living.
I'm curious about this because we talked about the electronic health records, the telemedicine. It says that pediatricians are so-so on it. It's not clear whether telemedicine has whatever moment it's going to have or if the uptake was just stalled, but 62% of you will not be introducing it into your practice in 2018, and another 29% of you aren't sure if you will or will not. And basically this is having a visit via telephone or even like a Skype session where you're talking to your patients, right?
Right. But the problem in pediatrics is our patients oftentimes are not able to talk or turn the computer on or do that. Our patient is the kid, not the parent. And it's difficult to know what is going on with the kid if they can't tell you something hurts or not. So taking the parent's interpretation of what's going on, I think he might have an ear infection and just, you know, not doing your job basically by, you know, giving the kid a solid and taking a look at him to make sure it is in fact an ear infection and not a tooth coming through or something else is still going to be the better practice in pediatrics. I mean, we treat very little over the phone. I mean, if a kid is puking or having diarrhea or needs, you know, help with toilet training or those type of things, you know, certainly could be discussed via telemedicine. But for an acute, you know, my kid is sick and has a fever of 103, you know, that there's nothing different from a mother telling me that, you know, face to face on a computer screen or telling me that on the phone if I can't examine the kid.
Yeah.
And I get paid absolutely $0 for telephone advice when I'm on call. There's no reimbursement in place for telephone medical advice, which often takes, you know, 10, 15 minutes. And, you know, my philosophy is anytime I'm performing a service that I can get sued for, I should get paid for.
Yep.
So that's how I look at it. But the insurance companies don't see it that way. And the telecommunication, the telemedicine stuff is not highly reimbursable either. It's certainly not on the level of actually physically seeing the child in the office. And when the patients are little kids and other people's kids, it's a big responsibility. And I'm not going to make a call on anything that's important, prescribing an antibiotic or a steroid medicine. I'm not going to make that call without laying my hands on the kid. I'm sorry. A lot of times I'm not confirming what the parents suspect because the kid may have an ear infection, but by examining the kid, I cannot miss a tonsil or abscess or something else that's going on.
Yeah.
You know, parents have one interpretation, but I look in all the holes.
Yeah.
Okay. That's my job.
Yeah. The other thing that they talk about, which we kind of already hit on, was the e-prescription. So they, and it seems like doctors are way into this.
Loving it.
Yeah, they said factors to have positively affected your practice. The increase in e-prescribing was hands down the most appreciated, 43.6%, which is higher than additional staff being a benefit to your practice. That was only 18.3%, and the increases in Medicaid reimbursements, so money, was only 10.3%. So yeah, the e-prescribing, being able to just send it off to the pharmacy, done, boom, everything's great.
And it's so easy. There's less mistakes, no bad handwriting or anything. And it's so, encrypted that, they know who's sending it. It's just been that's a godsend. Plus, the other benefit from that is every time you type in a new prescription, any kind of contraindication or cross reaction with other medications on their medication list, that pops up. Allergies pop up, so that there's less mistakes with prescribing medicines people are allergic to. And, a lot of things interact with other medicines. So knowing, that one might be better than another one because it interacts with the one they have to be on, helps you to do more safe practice for the patient's benefit. Less mistakes and just, patient loses. In my office with the paper prescriptions, I can write out one prescription per month previously for controlled substance. So if a mother loses the paper prescription for Adderall before she fills it, I can't write out another one.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like a check.
Now, if the pharmacy says it didn't come through,
you just click it.
Can send it again. So
that's
it
awesome.
Makes it a lot easier, and I think it makes it better for the patients. I write everything out. I have a little chart when I prescribe amoxicillin. I'll fill in blanks. It says take, and I'll say 10 mls, and then another blank 2 times a day then I'll put in 10, and then there's a little graph chart there so they can check off the doses as go. So I do that whenever they leave, and then, to know that what they got in their hand from me is going to match what's on the prescription, there's no mistakes now. The pharmacist could read, used to be, read 2 teaspoons and put 2 tablespoons on the label. And, I had a kid who I wrote a prescription for Zyrtec for when it was still prescription, and the kid got Zyprexa, which is an antipsychotic medication. I have very neat handwriting. It's been commented upon many
times.
But it's
just human error can happen.
Right. And this
it's makes less
it
likely
so
if
much
you make
clearer.
It a click thing, or and there's redundancies in software that can say, hey, is this what you want? That kind of stuff.
And you can even have like for amoxicillin, which I prescribe all the time, I have my favorites on my list of instructions. So 5 mls twice a day, 7.5 mls twice a day, 10 mls twice a day. So those are already in there because I use them frequently. So I don't even have to really input. I can click on 5 mls twice a day for 10 days and it fills in the rest of the prescription.
That's
for
awesome.
Me. So, yeah, that's very helpful. It's also helpful that patients that go see specialists or, get a prescription at a walk-in, if the parents use one of the, chains like a CVS or a Walgreens or Rite Aid, all of the prescriptions from other doctors get uploaded into their medication list on my EHR, so that then I could look at it and verify, who prescribed it and everything. So I'm not only having in my system the prescriptions I write for, but if outside prescriptions get written, they're also imported into the kid's EHR. So I have those there. So it's helpful. They go see an asthma doctor. He puts the kid on 3 medications and boom, the prescription goes through. They're already in my chart.
Wow. This one is something I wish that was more covered in the news, even though since not working at a news station, I don't follow the news very much, but it says, to believe many media reports in the media, Medicaid patients are being left to fend for themselves when it comes to their access to care. In fact, almost 87% of you are still accepting new patients who are on the program. That said, your single biggest fear about any new healthcare law is what its impact will be on Medicaid. Here's a quote from a doctor saying, "My practice is the largest provider for Medicaid in our state. There has always been healthcare for poor children."
Absolutely. And that's been my experience in Connecticut. There's always been subsidized health care for kids. We don't pay for the majority of the vaccines that we give. They're provided by the state for kids under the age of 5. birth to 60 months. So all of the, you know, we charge to administer them, but the state sends us an order every month of the vaccines that we think we're going to go through. So kids have always been vaccinated. Connecticut has a very high, almost 98%, one of the higher states in the country for, you know, percentage of kids vaccinated. And every other insurance company, you know, private insurance companies all base their rates on what the Medicaid rates are. So any effect on Medicaid
doesn't only
affect our Medicaid patients. You know, it affects the trickle down effect to all the other insurers, too. And in Connecticut, we have the Husky program. That's a part of the CHIPS program that they were going to eliminate, like I think I said. And, you know, they hold that like a carrot every time it comes up. It's horrible. But we're talking about children getting health care and children being immunized against diseases. And there shouldn't even be a discussion about it. It should just be. So I'd say probably 30% of my practice is Medicaid Husky patients, and the rest are probably private insurers. And I can tell you that, you know, the reimbursement is pretty equitable for both. I mean, it used to be, you know, private insurers might pay a little more or give you incentive dollars at the end of the year if you use generic prescribing practices and stuff, but you don't see that stuff anymore. And like I said, Medicare, Medicaid sets the bar for what the value of a code is, and then everyone else follows from there.
This is an interesting thing because it goes back to the electronic health records that we were talking about earlier. Is that this is number six? Is that stress? 70% of pediatricians in this survey reporting an increased stress level at work, and that 56% of you are shouldering a higher workload than last year, and then it breaks that down as to why. 68% increased administrative work. So that's the EHRs, right? The electronic health records.
EHR, filling out forms for insurance company, writing notes for kids to get services at school, reading through specialist reports on patients that you referred to them, calling parents back. And I don't get reimbursed for any of that time. And because, you know, the overlords that run our practice look at my schedule, they only see my production as how many patients I see in a certain number of hours. There's no consideration for the 2.5 hours I spent at the hospital seeing babies before I come to the office, work, you know, working through lunch, working an hour later just to finish all of the phone calls and everything I have to do. And that has, you know, it's increased. If I could take one day off a week on top of my day off, I could fill that day with administrative stuff.
And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking that, you know, what we're really kind of, and we talked about this the last time you were on, is kind of the corporatization of healthcare in America. And that really, if you really look at it, I'm just now realizing, because at my first thought was like, well, why not just go your own as a pediatrician? But if you're a doctor, you know how to be a doctor, right? I can compare it to, you can even understand this comparison is like a comedian, is that many comedians are bad at the business side of comedy because they know how to make people laugh. Like that's what they're good at. They don't understand marketing and profit loss statements and that kind of stuff, right? So you need the benefit for a doctor or a pediatrician to go be a part of these like bigger practices is that they handle all your insurance bullshit. They handle all your payroll stuff for your staff and they handle the making sure that you're compliant with all of these.
Exactly. And they're able to negotiate in bulk with the insurance companies. And the hope is a larger group of doctors going to get a better rate than, you know, a mom and pop. So.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to kind of what we're saying is that in a sense, if you did remove the insurance aspect of it, if you treated healthcare to a certain extent, like a Starbucks, I guess, sure, it could still be corporatized. It could still be a business, but you take out the expense of a middle person. Then in theory, it would operate more effectively and more efficiently,
Not only the expense of the middle person, but the middle person is required to make profits for shareholders to pay out dividends.
Yeah.
So you're siphoning off efficiency and everything else as profit.
And all of the fingers are pointed towards the healthcare system, and none of it is pointed towards the insurance. Unless when people say healthcare, because I think as just a layperson, when they talk about healthcare, they're talking about hospitals and doctors. Like they're saying doctors are the ones moving the marionettes of money.
health insurance reform.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's health insurance reform. Healthcare has been available. Hospitals are open. Doctors are seeing patients, taking on new patients. It's not a health care problem because health care is out there. Nobody's turning anyone away. Right. It's a health insurance problem primarily because it's something everyone feels they're entitled to, but nobody wants to or has figured out how to fuck to pay for it.
Well put, Doc. All right, so we got our last two here on the
list.
Don't
you realize that the most important thing in our lives is our life, to be able to live, and that all the other bullshit is extraneous, because if you die, then you don't have the other bullshit either. So don't you think basic health care for everybody that decides to have a birth certificate, that's like the bare minimum of something that you should provide as a country? Well, don't you think you shouldn't bankrupt people because their son gets in a car accident and, you know, his hospital bill is $150,000 and you don't have insurance, so the rest of your life is dictated by 30 seconds of a freak accident that happened because the roads were wet? It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And you know what? Don't we all get our health insurance taken out of our paycheck?
Yep.
Don't we?
Most of us.
Who the fuck cares if the health insurance in our paycheck was called going to Connecticut or health insurance tax? It's the same goddamn money. It's just going to a different place. And if it was, you know, one company and we all paid into the same system with a sliding scale like we do with every other tax we have, and maybe because people don't want to see another tax, we call it, you know, keeping healthy something, you know, whatever. But having that taken out of your paycheck, not going to an insurance company, maybe going to the government, but the government's got to be fair. I'm not saying I'm for a one-person pay system unless it's fair. But if they're going to monopolize and screw us even more because they'd be the only one out there, then I'm not for it. But if it's a system that works, like the system they have now seems to work, at least for children. I can't comment for what it is in adult medicine. No, I don't know how
it works for adults, because I was a broke guy who didn't have medical insurance and I had to have an appendectomy. And their solution to the plan was for me to put a lien on my house because I owned a home and that would cover the cost. Right.
You let it rot in your belly, didn't you, Justin?
Yeah, well, what I did, yeah, exactly. They just walked away. And the only thing that, and I would argue, based on the conversations I've had with you, the only thing that I thought was not cool was they gave me a liquid, like they did a CAT scan on my appendix to make sure that my appendix was actually inflamed, and that was $17,000. But to cut me open and do the 45-minute procedure was only $14,000. And so as a consumer, I was like, well, it's cheaper for you to just cut me open and lay eyes on my appendix, which I would like to be able to make that decision for myself. Yeah. I would like to have a doctor come to me and say, here's the thing. We ran some blood tests, and he said this to me. He said that sometimes there's a German virus that can often masquerade as appendicitis. So your white blood cells aren't really spiking, though. We can't really tell. I could give you a CAT scan. And I could take a look at it, and then we would know for sure, probably, like, but maybe not. But it's going to cost you a lot more money. Or I could do the procedure, and we can go in and take a look at your appendix. And if you're okay having a suture, like and a scar, even, and if I get in there and it's not inflamed, that'll save you about $3,000. And 21-year-old Justin would have said,
"And we'll take it out while we're in there, so you don't have to worry about it ever again."
Or give me that option. I mean, it's my fucking body. Why can't I do it the way I want to do it, right? So, and then I would be able to go, "Oh, okay." But instead, what happens is they go, "We have a great program. Don't worry about it." And then it's more about of hospital or a doctor negotiating with the parameters of an insurance company than it is about negotiating the care of the patient and what the patient wants. And it's the other thing, to go back to your point about what people are willing to pay. I've talked about how I go to this, essentially it's a chiropractor, and I know that you're like,
I go to my chiropractor once a month.
But what I'm saying is this is a chiropractor who has
that's right. He's treating your colon flora and fauna.
Yes,
that's
correctly. Right. Yes. And I realized in retrospect, looking back at this, is that what this really is somebody who I paid $9,000 to go to a nutritionist and have them educate me. And And that's a lot of money, right? But here's the reason why it takes $9,000 is because I'm a fucking moron. That's what it is. And I needed to get an education. And when you pay $9,000 for something, you pay a little bit more attention to what's going on with you. And you are invested. Whereas if it's always coming out of your paycheck and you go to the doctor, there's a chance that you're not invested. But the argument that this doctor gives is that what she says is that she's like, listen, she goes, and I get it that you're like, I can't take time off from work or whatever. And she says, but if you can't see that your health and taking care of yourself isn't going to affect your ability to go to work or to provide for your family, then you won't work with our program because your priorities aren't in the right place. And that I wholeheartedly agree with. And the other thing is, and this is where I get too political as well, where the thing that I saw come out of the Affordable Health Care Act that frustrated me was that the real big thing was I get a pre-existing condition. I don't think you should get nailed for a pre-existing condition. That's
just changing insurance company. It should all be a wash.
Yeah, it should, and it should. That should be a regulation. But to require employers to provide full-time benefits and health care for anybody who is working a 40-hour work week, all you did was increase the part-time employee status in America. That's
what Walmart's always done.
And that's what they're doing at the radio station. Now we have 80 bajillion, and now it becomes a big deal for you to become full-time. And before that point, and I don't even think it has to do with the fact that I was in my 20s and didn't have kids. Before that point, fuck all if I had health care, because I figured it out. I could figure out a way to get health care on my own, or my wife had a health care. So now I can't progress in my career, even though I have health care through my wife, because the company doesn't want to offer me a full-time position, because then they're on the hook to pay for my full health care benefits.
Right. You have your arms tied. There's nothing you could do with that. That technically could go, especially in small businesses, it should. But, you know, we've always provided, and even, I think even with our company, it's 32 hours a week is considered full time.
29 is my cap. If I go more than 29, and I think they say that because 32 is the legal limit or something.
Yeah.
And that's so I can work a couple hours extra.
8-hour days.
Yeah. It's bullshit, man.
I think that's what it is. And, you know, but again, even for me, when they calculate my salary, you know, if they don't pay me by the hour, but if they did, because there says a total number of hours on my paycheck, even though it's not influencing the draw, you know, they have me down for like over 2 weeks, like 87 hours. I mean, I work 36 hours in the office over 2 weeks. That's double that. Plus the hospital, the phone calls, the not getting a lunch, the time I spend on my computer taking my American Board of Pediatrics exam, 50 hours of continuing medical education a year, having to go to all these goddamn meetings to learn how to use the different hospitals' EHR. I mean, that's not counted in there, but it all counts. It's all part of my job. I mean, my job, and it seems like corporatization, is being determined primarily by what I generate in terms of seeing patients. But I'm not supposed to – my compensation for seeing patients should also be able to compensate me in turn for the time that I'm not being paid for, on-call, answering phone calls, going to meetings, things like that. Essentially, those are all still part of my job.
Well, imagine if you could have a private practice and we treated it like TriWink.com. It's no different than a wine bottle delivery service, right? And you pay a monthly fee to be a part of it. So if you could have it be like any of these box services or anything, where it's like, if I as a patient, let's say it's if you work out as a doctor,
you mean like I should have a Patreon practice?
Yes. But I mean, honestly, realistically, we could have accidentally just stumbled on the solution to the health care problem, right? Is that if a doctor's office just had to have a threshold of patients, right? Like, let's say you knew that you and if you could handle more, like you could, then you
it's being done. There's a woman who's an internist. She left her private practice. She opened up a concierge medical thing. She said, I will take 300 patients, $2,000 a year to be part of that priority VIP group. Uh-huh. She'll only have those 300 patients. So she's priming the pumps with $600,000 just to be part of the thing. And then she says, I will bill your insurance company and, you know, I'll keep whatever they pay. But if they, you know, don't cover things, I will write that off as, you know, as part of the yearly fee.
Brilliant.
So she's starting off bringing in, you know, more than I bring in a half a year, you know, just to, and she has no overhead because she doesn't have an office. She drives to the people's homes to examine them. They still have their health insurance, which she bills, and also because she's able to order blood work and send them to the hospital and order x-rays and stuff. And then they have, you know, just a yearly fee they pay to be part of it. And all of her attention is only concentrated on those 300 patients. And she's she's available 24/7. There's nobody else working with her. Some of it's over the phone. Some of it is in person at the house. But you know, it's happening.
As this becomes successful, what she could do is if she brings on a secondary person, she extends that 300 to 500, say. And then that gives those extra 500 people afford her the ability to have a manager or a secretary or assistant who can handle scheduling and take some of the workloads. And that's the way I think it should be. That's the way you build an actual business. And then the people who are making the decisions are people who got into this to take care of people make a profit.
Well, you know what? I mean, I keep thinking that that day is going to come where I'm just going to get a Winnebago and I'm going to show up at CVS parking lots and I'm going to go to 3-4 different towns. That'll increase my catchment area, you know?
It'll be like Chef, the movie for restaurants. It'll be that for doctors. You just have
Remember Trapper John M.D.?
No.
Trapper used to sleep on the Winnebago in the parking lot at the hospital.
I don't remember that. That's funny. No,
I'd be seeing patients.
That's funny. The
people would think it was like some kind of a drug sale place because they'd see people coming and going, bags in their hands.
To interrupt you, but just for the sake of getting all these numbers, number 7 is that help is on the way. And it's basically saying that more than 20% of you have added a nurse practitioner in the last month. Another 17% are considering.
I've had a nurse practitioner since 1995. I was a pioneer. They only worked at the hospitals. One of the best hospital ones was retiring from the hospital when the children's hospital was opening. I said, you want to come and work in private practice? And I started that trend. She started working for me in 1995. She has since retired, but I have 2 nurse practitioners working for me now, primarily not for extra help, but I let them deal with all the womanly issues that come in. Yeah. I had daughters. I gave it home. I don't need it.
the other thing, which is exactly what we're talking about, is that more doctors are opting to work for a hospital and become an employee rather than have a private practice. And I think it's because of just how complicated everything is. And it simplifies it to where it allows you to focus on being a doctor and doing it that way. But the last one, which I think will transition to what we're going to talk about for the last segment here, is 47.9% of you said that parental resistance to immunization negatively affected your practice this year, placing it as one of the top 5 downer factors, right behind maintenance of certification requirements.
Board exams, that's the requirement. I just finished up. I'm cool till 2024.
Yeah. We need clear advocacy for the value of vaccines. One doctor said AAP is great for kids, but not so great for pediatricians. It's not coming out full force against anti-vaxxers, which is what their complaint is. And I think we're going to actually wrap this up and talk a little bit more about the flu vaccine. I know that Dr. J talk about this a lot. And you know what? If you think we talk about it too much, please send us an email, because I kind of use my own myself as a barometer, in that even though before meeting Dr. J, I never had a flu shot, never got one. Now it's routine, even though this year I was late. And then I did a vaccination kind of research thing for KFI and was kind of shocked about what I found. And so since then, I really find it interesting. And what's so funny is that it seems to be something that we're kind of making it white noise, but it really is important. And the fact that the flu isn't a bigger deal is because of vaccinations. And that's what I find so interesting. It seems there's like a yin yang snake eating itself effect on it. But anyway, we'll talk more about it after this break. I want a new drug. One that won't make me sick. One that won't make me crash my car and make me feel free, free, free. I want a new drug. One that won't hurt my head. One that won't make my mouth too dry and make my eyes too red. So this is one that you sent us, Dr. J. Why your excuses for not getting a flu shot stink, which I love. So we're just going to kind of go through these real quick. I want to read this top part. Since 2010, the flu has resulted in 140,000 to 710,000 hospitalizations each year and contributed to between 12,000 and 56,000 deaths. According to estimates from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, 744 adults who had a cough, a cold, or the flu in the previous 12 months, only 48% said that they had the flu shot. So this is great because what it does is it gives the common excuses that people give for not getting a flu shot, and then it kind of shoots them down. So number one is the vaccine doesn't work. The typical year, the shot cuts your risk of getting the flu by 40 to 60%. And if you get the flu anyway, your symptoms will be milder, which I you probably said that, but that's something that just didn't stick in my head when I read that. It's like, oh, so it, even if it, you still get the flu, it's not as bad as it would have been if you didn't have the shot, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And even, they're saying even if you don't hit the right strain that's circulating, that you do get some protection, and it'll make it less less complications, less likely to go to the hospital, you know, and it shortens the course, which is all that Tamiflu does. So, I mean, the logic of people is really incredible because they resist getting a flu vaccine, which is going to maybe prevent you from getting the flu entirely, but will in most cases help shorten the course of the flu. But people would rather not get the vaccine, catch the flu, then go to the doctor for Tamiflu, which is not going to kill the flu. It doesn't kill the flu. It decreases its replication so that what it does is it shortens the course of the flu by about 29 hours in adults and only about 15 hours for children. Wow. So the logic is let me catch it and then take something that's going to take a day off of it, which has side effects of delirium and hallucinations, or you get the vaccine and you may cut 2 days off of flu if you catch it.
Wow.
So to say it doesn't work is not true because it works. And, you know, this article said 40 to 60%. You know, this year's vaccine, the CDC is saying working about 35%. But we've had years where it's been 65% effective in the last 10 years. So all in all, it's probably a good idea to do. We don't always get hit with a different strain that is new to a lot of people like we are this year. You know, so this year it's, you know, it's pretty late in the season. We probably all see flu through the beginning of April. So it takes 2 to 4 weeks for you to convert to the vaccine. So if you haven't gotten the flu vaccine, well, geez Louise, time is a-wasting.
Well, and I'll hit this article that I found in looking around because it connects to what we're talking about right here is that, you know, you were the one that taught us that the flu vaccine, like the flu season is the opposite end of the year for China and Australia, like that side of the globe. So that's how we see it coming. And they anticipated that this flu vaccine wasn't going to be effective. And they said that it was about 10% effective overall against H3N2 in Australia. And then
in
Canada, that jumped up to 17%. And that they've seen that this year's flu vaccine is 25% effective in America against H3N2 strain of the flu. And the bigger surprise is that the vaccine is about 51% effective in children. And this is according to CDC's preliminary analysis of this year. So they thought it wasn't going to be effective.
Right.
And now when they're in the throes of the season, they're like, oh, it actually is really effective.
Yeah.
I love the way that this doctor.
That's a recent article. That's two. That just came out, 2 days ago?
2 days ago.
CDC article.
Right? The medical director of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, Dr. William Shafter, said, you're less likely to have complications, less likely to be admitted to the hospital. And I love this. And less likely to die.
Yeah,
and that's like the thing I think that we've kind of become numb to is that there people will die and have died from the flu. And it's anyway, excuse number two.
And that article that you referenced before, you know, the numbers are staggering. When you see the number of deaths even last year, and the majority of those people didn't get the flu vaccine. Between 2010, 2016, two-thirds of the 675 children and teenagers who died of the flu did not get a vaccine that year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is staggering that is still the case when there's so much good information out there and a lot of bad information that you got to weed your way through. But that's why I do these goddamn podcasts.
That's
right.
They're projecting that this flu season is expected to kill more than 50,000 Americans. Like this, this flu season seems to be a very dangerous one compared to ones in the past. Excuse number
two. 100-year anniversary of the worst one ever. I think we talked about that one last time.
So. Oh, yeah.
1918.
It can cause the flu. The flu vaccine causes almost all flu vaccines use an inactive virus that can't trigger the flu. But because the vaccine doesn't eliminate your chance of getting the flu, only reduces it, some people who develop the flu after getting the shot wrongly blame the vaccine. The flu mist, a nasal spray vaccine that uses a weakened live virus, can cause mild flu-like symptoms, but not a full-blown infection. In any case, the CDC isn't recommending flu mist because it's not expected to work well against this season's viral strain.
Well, there's something wrong with what's going on with it because they pulled it last year because they said it wasn't working against the year before's virus. So there's something going on there I'm not quite sure of. Always better not to have any extra live viruses circulating if we don't need to. Right now, the only weakened live viral vaccines we have are the measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox vaccine, and the rotavirus vaccine. Polio is all inactivated polio now.
This I found really enlightening. The excuse is there's harmful mercury in flu vaccines. A mercury-containing preservative called thimerosal? How do you say that?
Thimerosal.
Thimerosal is in certain vaccines, but it's only a trace amount, and that kind of mercury, ethyl mercury, is eliminated by the body more quickly than methyl mercury, which is found in some seafood.
Exactly. And you know,
but nobody's
about 15 years ago, you know what? Any Visine commercial you ever saw had thimerosal in it as a preservative. So, you know, the tiny amount that is used in the processing of vaccines, and I'm going to get back to this in a second, but we were putting like pure thimerosal into our eyeballs back in the 60s. So,
wow.
But here's the deal with the flu vaccine and mercury. If you get a vaccine that is a pre-filled syringe, which is what most pediatricians do, it's a pre-filled syringe. You just have to open it up, put a needle on the end, and give the vaccine. None of the vaccines that come as pre-filled syringes for the flu have any thimerosal in them at all. It's the multi-dose flu vaccines where you get a vial that has 10 doses in it and you have to draw it out of the vial in order to fill up the 10 syringes because it has a longer shelf life, and that does have a small amount of thimerosal in it, which is essentially harmless because there used to be thimerosal in a bunch of different vaccines as a preservative just to increase the shelf life. But because of the concern about mercury causing autism, except for the multi-dose vials of the flu vaccine, no pediatric vaccines have thimerosal in them anymore, and haven't for over, you know, almost 20 years. And we see more autism now than we did when we had mercury in the vaccine. So,
yeah. It says here numerous studies have discredited the idea that thimerosal is linked to autism.
Right.
And then it goes in to say that there are many thimerosal-free options, which is the ones that you're describing. Right. The other thing I wanted to point out in these two articles, I just want to go through because we're doing great on time here, is that I did all of pediatrics. Oh, you did that one. I love this analogy that Mr. Azar said. The vaccine is 39% effective overall and 59% effective in children. He compared the vaccine to seatbelts. Imagine if we could cut our chances of being in a car crash by 39% or our children's by 59%, he said. The comparison was only partly correct, but very apt because seatbelts, studies done since the 1970s have shown them to be only 40% protective against preventing any injury in a car crash. So in theory, a flu vaccination is more effective protecting your kid from the flu than a seatbelt is from a car crash, and yet 2/3 of people or more are not getting their kids vaccinated. That's insane. And yet, also, here's the other interesting part about it, if you really want to go back to getting political, is that, at least in the state of California, you are required to buckle up your kid by law because that is what is there. You don't get to decide how safe your kid is in a vehicle.
That's right.
You don't get to make that decision. And yet we have government agencies like an FDA that are supposed that look at these things and decide whether or not they're good or bad. And yet for some reason, I'm assuming this I sound like such a douchey, soapboxy asshole right now, but I'm assuming it's because politicians are more concerned with re-election than anything. And so all it takes is to have enough constituents that are anti-vaccination. And you're like, well, I don't want to touch that. That can't be a required thing.
That's right. That's right. It's just like everything else. You know, and it's funny, too, because you got to have the kid by law. You got to have the kid buckled into the seat. And now they've taken away our ability to sip a cocktail while driving with a kid in a car seat. Now you can't smoke in a car with a child in it. I mean, all of our rights are being taken away.
Exactly. But you can't give him you can't make him get a shot. Well, you know, put, Dr.
Zane. You have a nice pina colada in the drink holder. You know.
Why are we so uptight all of a sudden? I don't understand. Why can't we be loosey-goosey like things were in the 50s and 60s, right?
The next thing you know, they're going to pass a law saying you can't make waffles on in your car while you're driving, or you can't type on a computer pad on your dashboard while you're driving. I mean that would be
or text
silly,
right? Like they're already doing that. When they do that, I'm moving to Canada. I'll tell you that right now. I'm moving to Canada when they do that. That is bullshit.
Well, I already said when they take away my toys at my office, I'm done, and I've been about a year now toyless. So you know, you
caved.
Got to live. Well, you know what? Tell the kids to bring their own goddamn toys. I guess. You know what toy they play with? Their mother's cell phone.
Boom.
Which is what we're trying to get them not to do.
Right.
So, and I'm having blocks and puzzles. I'm pushing media and video enjoyment upon my patients. Oh, it's all back ass words.
One of my favorite things about regulations is when it has unintended consequences that fly in the face of the very thing that those same people who made the regulations are also pushing against. It's great. It's always.
I have in my room, I've got cabinets and counters so that they will accommodate the sink and the baby scale. And I had a baby scale in each examination room because I figured you take the kid from the exam from the waiting room, get them right in an exam room, and then they're pretty much free of germs while they're at the office, you know. So they came in and they said that my scales were a half an inch too close to the sink and there was risk of an electric short. I got battery powered goddamn scales, Justin.
Wow. I'm sorry.
So now I have a central weighing area in the hallway where the babies now go to the room, get undressed into their underwear. The mother's got to carry them out into the hallway, wait in line if there's other people to be weighed, and then put the baby on the common scale, which, again, increases infections because there's more exposure. And they took away my goddamn toys to reduce the spread of infection. So it's spinning round and round with stupid regulations that don't end up, they don't add up to common sense is what they don't do.
Yeah. All right. That was our show. Send an email to show@thedadpodcast.com if you have questions for Dr. J that you would like to ask. Or if you're driving around in your car and you realize you have a question, the other thing you could do is call 877-222-8323. That's 877-222-8323. And you can leave a voicemail that we can play the next time we have Dr. J on next month. You can check him out at standuppediatrician.com and find out when Dr. J is coming to a city near you with his standing up comedy. Or you can follow him on Twitter at Dr. J Sute. He is also a regular at our fan page, Staying Frosty with the Dad Podcast. If you want to join that group, you'll see Dr. J chiming in from time to time there. Email in your questions. And what's the other podcast that you also are on so people can check that out too?
I do the David Feldman Show.
David Feldman Show. So check out David.
It's kind of like half interviewing comedians, half interviewing political people. And it's kind of a mishmash of stuff. But he and I did a show together, much like how you and I met. And I cracked him up. So I've been doing that, every other week pretty much.
So throw that into your podcast rotation. Again, it's the David Feldman Show, and that is in the description of this episode as well. And I think that's it. So on behalf of the fantastic Dr. J. Sute, this is Justin Worship saying hug your kids, hump your loved one, and stay frosty, my friend.